The North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week, the Independent, and I'm John Federson, here to read you this week's issue of the Independent Journal, and it's dated June the 13th of 2025, and here we go. All right, and I'll give you a sort of a front pager, which came out on June 11th. Court filing alleges a fired Raleigh Police Department officer conducted illegal searches. A Wake County woman is asking the local district court not to use evidence and testimony from a former Raleigh police officer against her on charges of driving while impaired, misdemeanor child abuse, and failing to stop at a red light. Dominique Jeffries was arrested and charged in September 13th of 2024. The arresting officer, Kyle Epps, was fired from the police department in April following an internal investigation, the details of which were not released. Additionally, the motion states, quote, upon information and belief, hundreds of cases in which Epps was the charging officer have been voluntarily dismissed. Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman told Indy that dozens is an appropriate description of how many cases involving Epps her office has dismissed. She wrote in an email to Indy, because we have reviewed these on a case-by-case basis to identify public safety concerns and how the Brady information applies to the case, we have not kept a count on the total number, but it does not exceed 100. This comes as Freeman dropped more than 200 cases against two state troopers in response to their actions following a crash that killed 31-year-old Tyrone Mason. In a report on her decision not to charge the troopers, Freeman criticized RPD for its handling of that crash investigation. The motion to suppress, filed Tuesday, accuses Epps of malfeasance in Jeffrey's case and three others. Raleigh Police said in a request for comment it was not authorized to provide information besides Epps' hiring and separation date, but noted that no criminal charges have been filed against Epps. The motion states that Epps said he pulled Jeffries over after he observed her turning left at an intersection with a red light on North Arundel Avenue in Zebulon. Jeffries had her child with her in the car, and in his arrest report, Epps claims Jeffries was, quote, slow to stop and swerving in the roadway, leading him to believe Jeffries was driving while impaired. He claims Jeffries, quote, was very talkative and had an odor of marijuana coming from her breath. He claims Jeffries told him she had recently smoked marijuana with her brother and was on her way to drop off her daughter at her mother's house nearby. Epps then asks Jeffries to walk to the rear of the car and claims she, quote, stumbled over her own feet. He asked her to rate herself on a sobriety scale from 0 to 10, and she rated herself a 2. He asked Jeffries if she had any medical issues or injuries that would prevent her from completing a field sobriety test. Jeffries told him she had cancer that caused problems with her legs. Epps said, according to the report, what I'm going to do is frisk. The report continues, an officer must have reasonable suspicion that a subject is armed and a reasonable suspicion the subject is dangerous to conduct a lawful frisk. No articulable reasonable suspicion was noted on the body cam footage to suggest the passenger was armed, and no reasonable suspicion was observed to indicate that the passenger was dangerous. Epps admitted in the internal affairs interview that the passenger was polite and cooperative. Still, he frisked the passenger and searched his vehicle, but found no weapons or contraband. The report concludes detention, frisk, and search violated the Fourth Amendment rights on the occupants of the vehicle. The filing states that the state's decision to dismiss cases involving Epps certainly suggests they themselves have apprehensions regarding his credibility. As such, the state lacks the requisite, reasonable, articulable suspicion to support the above-referenced charges. Next, two articles dealing with the recent protests, one in District of Columbia and the other in Raleigh. When police officers approached Sylvia Carroll in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda last Monday, her eyes were closed and her hands were raised in prayer. She was among protesters demonstrating against proposed cuts to Medicaid and SNAP benefits. Carroll says, "I was asking the Lord to just open these people's eyes to who are trying to take this away and have them put themselves in our seats as disabled people." Carroll, a disabilities rights advocate who lives with cerebral palsy and uses a wheelchair, was among three Durham residents arrested during a June 10th Moral Monday demonstration led by Reverend Bishop William Barber II. Lee Anderson, a music minister at Eden Street Methodist Church, and Reverend Franklin Golden, who leads Durham Presbyterian Church, were also arrested, as well as Barber and a handful of others. Officers hesitated before placing zip ties on her wrists. The restraint had different implications than it would for someone who can walk, as it would prevent her from moving her wheelchair. But they proceeded with the arrest. Before the arrests, Carroll spoke to a large crowd outside the Capitol about how the cuts would personally impact her. "When we have a procedure that needs to be done, how will that be paid for?" she asked the crowd. Carroll lives independently with a roommate in Durham. The cuts could force her to choose between basic necessities and depleting her savings. After paying monthly bills, she's left with around $200. And like 1.5 million North Carolinians, depends on SNAP benefits to buy groceries. Sloane Meek, who is in the band Meek Squad with Carroll and Anderson, lives around the corner from Carroll and traveled to D.C. with that group, also spoke to the crowd. Meek lives with cerebral palsy, blindness, and epilepsy. Meek told the crowd, "Without Medicaid support in my home and community, I'll be forced into a nursing home to spend the rest of my life in a hospital bed until I die." Parentheses, about 3 million people in North Carolina rely on Medicaid for health insurance. Linicum said, I'm trying to figure out who Linicum is. There's no mention of that name. So we have this great community that offers natural support. Most people don't have that. We are a family now, but I do get paid for support to support him. My whole job is supported by Medicaid. House Republicans have proposed reducing federal funding for Medicaid and SNAP by nearly $1 trillion. Supporters of the cuts claim they won't harm people with disabilities. The group of Durham advocates say that's misleading. While people with disabilities would be exempt from new and expanded work requirements for Medicaid and SNAP, respectively, those requirements only account for a small fraction of cuts to the programs. The remaining cuts would create funding gaps for states, with home and community-based supports for people with disabilities likely among the first services eliminated. Meek tells the Indy, "North Carolina is just now opening up the waiting list for Medicaid waiver services that help people in their homes and communities. After waiting over 10 years, most people are finding they now have the funding but can't find the staffing to help. How will that improve if there are these big cuts?" Carroll says it's basically, it feels like it's people telling us, people with disabilities, that we don't belong here. We're not welcome here. They're trying to shut us away to kill you off, says Linicum. That's what it feels like. Carroll, Anderson, and Golden spent 2.5 hours in detention after being arrested, released with citations for crowding, obstructing, or incommoding, a misdemeanor. Carroll says the night before that demonstration, she began crying unexpectedly while walking near the Capitol with friends, saying, "I was like, I don't know where these tears are coming from, but I can't believe that me and my friends will be here telling our stories and being able to speak up for what we need and advocate for what we need. It was also my first time going to Washington, D.C. I think that was another thing. I was like, man, this is so cool. The next article by Chloe Bowl, The Surge of Pro-Immigrant, Anti-Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE protests that began in Los Angeles on Friday spread from coast to coast over the weekend, arriving in Raleigh on Monday. Organized locally by the Union of Southern Service Workers, USSW, which represents low-wage workers in the service industry, the Oak City's protest drew more than 150 people to Moore Square in the middle of a workday in spite of unrelenting sun and sticky 87-degree heat. They gathered to demand an end to ICE workplace raids, as well as the release of David Huerta, the president of the Service Employees International Union of California, who was arrested over the weekend and has since been released on bond. Unlike in L.A., where police and federal agents dressed in camouflage and riot gear quelled protests with tear gas, pepper spray, flashbang grenades, and non-lethal bullets, Raleigh's demonstration was completely peaceful, with almost no visible law enforcement presence. Union leaders and immigrants' rights activists took turns firing up the crowd with chants and speeches in English and Spanish. At the margins of the protest, they'd set up stations with water and snacks. The signs, the attendees' signs read, "Abolish ICE, ICE equals KKK, and free David now." Huerta, the California union organizer, is one of at least 40 people who have been arrested in L.A. A video shows police officers knocking him to the ground as he attempted to document an immigration enforcement raid. Local media reported he sustained serious injuries and was briefly hospitalized. He now faces a felony charge that carries up to a 6-year sentence. Keith Bullard, an organizer with USSW, told the Moore Square crowd, "This assault isn't just an attack on David. It's an attack on every immigrant, every worker, every family, and every community. This is all of our struggle. This is just another form of stop and frisk." Manzoor Chima, an organizer with Muslims for Social Justice, said ICE was created against Muslims, but it's expanded to everybody. In the labor union, we say an injury to one is an injury to all. Other speakers included Tamika Walker Kelly, president of the North Carolina Association of Educators, and Claudia De La Cruz, who ran for U.S. president in 24 as a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Anderson Clayton, chair of the North Carolina Democratic Party, attended but did not give a speech. De La Cruz said, "These kidnappers, better known as ICE, are going into our communities. They're kidnapping our people. They're terrorizing our people. And we should not allow for the narrative that is coming out right now. The people who are protesting are criminals." Nikki Marin Baena, co-director of Siembra North Carolina, told Indy on Monday that her organization has not heard of ICE raiding workplaces in the Triangle, but Siembra, a Hispanic-led immigrants' rights nonprofit, is preparing for that possibility by running a 24-hour hotline and running a Know Your Rights workshops. The group is also doing outreach to employers and encouraging them to exercise their right to deny federal agents entry to a workplace without a warrant. Mama Cookie, one of the founders of USSW, told Indy that defending immigrants' rights and labor rights go hand in hand. "USSW is going nowhere," she said. "We're going to stand and fight with every union that needs us." Another protest in Moore Square, this one organized by the Party for Socialism and Liberation, is planned for 6 p.m. on Wednesday. And I'm recording this on Thursday. I have not read anything about that particular protest, whether it's occurred or not. Well, that concludes those two protest-related articles. And continuing now in Indie Week, the arrangement of articles I'm reading to you is more random than I usually do, and I'm just taking them in order that they come in my pile of articles. This one is by Andrea Richards and was written on June 10th in praise of Reflections, and it's about a program at the Nasher Museum of Art at Duke University. That program happens the second Tuesday of every month at 2 p.m., and she writes, "My 86-year-old father and I are cutting up, causing a commotion at the end of a long table where we are creating a piece of art alongside a group of other Nasher Museum of Art visitors. It's Tuesday afternoon, and we're moving small pieces of plastic, like broken CD cases, six-packs, lids, discarded toys, so they fit into a stencil in the shape of the United States. Our process is inspired by an artwork we saw earlier on our museum tour, artist Tony Cragg's Real Plastic Love, a piece where the artist uses reclaimed bits of plastic to create two dynamic dancing figures. Finding googly eyes, my dad holds them to his face. He's already got a plastic pink bow, I think it once belonged to Minnie Mouse, fashioned around the collar of his shirt like a bow tie. His goofing off is encouraged by our collaborators, other visitors and museum docents who laugh along with us. My dad has always had charisma, a career military chaplain and former minister. He's had a lifetime of practice in the art of shaking hands while cracking jokes. In the last few years, though, he's slowed down, becoming less social due to dementia. As his Alzheimer's progresses, it's becoming harder to find places where he feels comfortable. Restaurants and stores are loud and unfamiliar. Movies and sports, too hard to follow. And the outdoors, a physical challenge. Like many folks his age, he uses a rollator. That's why the Nasher's Reflection Tours, which are offered monthly to the public and designed specifically for individuals with dementia and Alzheimer's and their caregivers, are so helpful. Reflections offers individuals with dementia an opportunity to interact with people and art. Due to the nature of the disease, which can be isolating and make individuals self-conscious in social situations, such an opportunity is important. While studies show arts-based activities may help slow cognitive deterioration, two more tangible benefits of the Reflections program happen immediately: a chance to engage in community and in art. Ruth Cacavale, a museum educator who has worked on this program since its inception more than a decade ago, says, "One of the wonderful things about using visual art is that this object is right there in front of our visitors. They don't need linear thinking. They don't need to remember what was just said or the historical context of the work. They can keep referring to what they see right in front of them." Each monthly Reflections program begins with what the museum calls a radical welcome in the main hall, where participants are met enthusiastically, offered name tags, important when you have memory issues, and introduced to the program's facilitators, who also wear name tags. Another radical part of the welcome is that since the program requires an RSVP, staff know whom to expect and are positioned at the parking lot to help with access to the museum, offering a golf cart for those with mobility issues. This is a thoughtful touch, especially given the construction and confusing nature of parking on Duke's campus. After the welcome, docents lead a 45-minute tour that explores two or three works of art. Chairs are provided in front of each work, prioritizing visitor comfort. The docents, many of whom have worked in the program for years, facilitate a free flow discussion, asking questions and taking in every comment, frequently calling visitors by their names and encouraging dialogue. After the tour, the program alternates between a 45 art-making activity like our collage or a music program featuring professional musicians playing right in the galleries. When Reflections first began this program, Cacavale recounts, staff initially planned to host the program on Monday, the day the museum is closed to the public. They switched gears when they realized that attendees wanted access to the cafe. And for one more important reason, Cacabelli says the other benefit, too, is it's in another opportunity to normalize dementia for the rest of our staff. Normalizing dementia is necessary for many reasons. The disease is becoming much more common. According to the Alzheimer's Association, in North Carolina, over 210,000 over age 65 have it. That's 11.6% of the population over 65. Assisted by 370,000 caregivers helping them through it. And just as it is in the rest of the nation, Alzheimer's is a growing public health crisis in our state. Enhancing the quality of life for these families matters. And making arts and cultural resources more accessible to this growing population is one way to help. Another local option for North Carolinians living with dementia is the Dementia Alliance of North Carolina's Music and Memory at Home program, which supports an important role music plays in well-being. Like Reflections, the program is free of charge. The program provides a personalized playlist of music and easy-to-use equipment for listening to it for people with dementia. There's even music detectives who help individuals draft their playlists over Zoom. Then a fully loaded digital music player is shipped to the individual with all their favorite songs, along with headphones, a Bluetooth speaker, and an easy-to-follow written guide. I can attest, the process and equipment are as close to foolproof as is humanly possible. While there is less IRL socialization in this program, it offers a vital arts-based therapy that can be used daily and easily, like the group art making we did at Reflections. The Music and Memory at Home kit brings my family some shared joy, and that is a beautiful thing. Cacavale says the challenge of this program is that we want to keep it small. A tour for 50 is not the same as a tour for 14, the number that caps a Reflections group. Reflections works because the small group size allows for intimacy and individualized attention and care. As Reflections program coordinator Laura Toussaint attests, the small size is a big plus. Saying one of the caregivers commented that her mom loves music but could no longer go to the symphony. The huge crowds were too much. Being in a smaller group and having a musician 10 feet away was really appealing. Cacavale describes the constraints as a balancing act as her staff works to make Nasher's program more accessible to diverse communities within Durham. Along with leading multiple regular tours for the Duke Dementia Family Support Program, the museum offers the public program. You can sign up online to get on the mailing list for RSVPs, and a virtual Zoom once a month, as well for folks who can't get to the museum. They also work with assisted living communities and other community organizations to arrange tours. For Cacavale, expansion holds meaning beyond having more people with dementia come to Nasher. She says what we want is for everyone in the community to be on board creating programs for folks with dementia. The Lemur Center, Duke Chapel, DPAC, the Carolina Theater, the ballpark, she says. This vision and the possibilities for additional social connection and arts engagement it holds is exciting for those of us navigating life with a loved one who has the disease. What if funding existed for a plethora of cultural activities created specifically for people with dementia? While research shows the cognitive benefits of arts and social activity, specifically for individuals with dementia, but also for all of us, there's one thing studies can't show: the deep-hearted delight of connecting with a person you love, but sometimes feel unable to access. This is The ongoing gift of the Reflections program for me, its tours, provide time and space for me to connect via art and art-related activities to my father, and to do so in a community of other people who are also affected by dementia helps us all feel less alone. Along the way, there are unanticipated events, like my father goofing off with the art supplies, or another patron describing a painting as giving off a lot of heat, that occur, quiet and not so quiet, moments of real connection between people and paintings, people and art supplies, people and people, and in my case, a father and his daughter. Well, continuing our zooming around in the IndieWeek's articles, Raleigh City Council has adopted a $1.8 billion budget and funds firefighter pay raises. The budget, which the council passed unanimously on Monday, checks a lot of boxes. It funds staff pay raises, parks, infrastructures, and affordable housing. It doesn't increase property taxes, but one wish list item that did not make that cut is a separation allowance for firefighters. The temporary retirement benefit Raleigh firefighters have been asking for years. After a recent compensation study showed that the city of Raleigh underpays its employees compared to peer cities, City Manager Marshall Adams David and the City Council prioritized competitive staff pay raises in fiscal 26 budget. Firefighters are set to receive 11% raises next year, which will bring their starting salary up to a nationally competitive $57,000. I'm rounding up a little bit. At a Monday budget meeting, city staff told the council that in order to fund a separation allowance, firefighters would have to accept a 2.2% raise instead of 11. Staff also presented a survey conducted by the HR department in which a two-thirds majority of uniformed fire department employees said they would rather get the raise than the separation allowance. Funding both was not considered as an option, since the city is budgeting conservatively in an uncertain economy and was unwilling to raise new revenue through a property tax increase. In the past, Raleigh firefighters, including Fire Chief Herbert Griffin, have explained that they want a separation allowance because their job is unusually dangerous. Nationwide, firefighters have a 14% higher risk of dying from cancer than the general public, according to the Firefighter Cancer Support Network. In Raleigh, they've submitted 230 workplace first aid and injury claims since 2022. That's the third highest rate of any city department, behind the police department and solid waste services. By state law, by the way, Raleigh police have received separation allowance since 1987. No other city workers currently receive that benefit. Andrew Davis, president of the Professional Firefighters Association, told Indy in an email, "We are deeply disappointed by the lack of action by the council and manager in not funding this allowance for our firefighters. The association has been leading the charge on separation allowance and also has endorsed three-quarters of the sitting city council in the last election cycle." Davis wrote, "While 11% raises for our first responders seems like prioritization, please understand this is only to get us in line with our peers, meaning we had fallen way behind, and there's nothing to put us ahead. For over a decade now, the fire department has been stagnant in hiring new positions. Simply getting us in line with our peers does nothing to recruit and retain firefighters who can still go to other municipalities and attain equal, if not greater, compensation and benefits." Davis added he is optimistic the city council will reconsider separation allowance next budget season. Mitchell Silver, one of the endorsed council members, said on Monday, voting not to fund this allowance, quote, "the most challenging decision I've had to make as a council member. I would encourage the city manager to continue exploring opportunities to acknowledge the risk associated with firefighting, and I trust you will bring us something in the near future that could be considered for implementation. Councilmember Megan Patton, who the association also supported, says, I continue to support the benefit, but it's clear the path forward is not there. Despite there being no perfect solution on the table for fighters, the City Council seemed pleased with the budget overall. Mayor Janet Cowell said, it's a budget that's pretty easy to support in that there's no tax increase. Next article comes from over in Morrisville by Jane Porter. An anti-LGBTQ concrete company fails to weigh down the Morrisville Pride event. The early summer heat didn't dissuade hundreds of residents from attending the town's Pride in the Park event on Friday. Families with children spread out on picnic blankets on the lawn. Neighbors milled together with popsicles and ice cream, played drag bingo, and stopped to check out vendors selling everything from jewelry to saris to henna tattoos. And while a Beaufort, North Carolina-based concrete company that was approved as a vendor for the event tried to make its presence known, it was largely obscured by activists surrounding and blockading its tent with rainbow flags and umbrellas, its messaging drowned out by queer anthems and Disney songs. For at least the second year, the town of Morrisville approved an application from the anti-LGBTQ concrete company, whom the Indy is choosing not to name, as a vendor for its annual Pride event. Morrisville is one of the few municipalities in Wake County that solely funds and hosts this Pride event, according to a town council member who spoke with Indy, and residents were dismayed that the town approved a vendor known for promoting what they called anti-LGBTQ and transphobic messaging. Some residents and vendors, including Eli Cameron, a local transgender artist and community organizer, skipped the event in protest. A vendor who ran their own independent grassroots Pride market in 21, Cameron said they had been supportive of the town's early efforts to host its own event for the past 2 years. Quote, I was accepted as a vendor this year, but I've stepped back from participating because I cannot risk further exposure to hate speech under the guise of free speech at a Pride celebration, he wrote in an email. After last year's experience with transphobic and homophobic vendor who is being allowed to return again, I'll just stick with Apex and Raleigh Pride events, wrote resident Kenny Vandergriff on the town of Morrisville's Facebook page. Sorry, Morrisville. In recent years, Pride Month has run up against conservative politics in parts of Wake County, as the Indy has previously reported. In the lead-up to the event, Cameron and others had made inquiries to town staff about whether this vendor would be approved again. They were told that, due to the public nature of the event, the town was legally obligated to, quote, allow participation from all groups who meet basic registration requirements because of constitutional requirements, including protecting First Amendment rights. A communications staffer from the town sent along a similar statement to Indy on Monday, and that statement reads, the town took appropriate steps to ensure that the event remained a safe and vibrant experience for everyone attending. After research, the town attorney advised us that because this is a government-sponsored event held on public property, the Equal Protection Clause of both the state and federal constitutions prohibit Morrisville from excluding vendors based on their opinions or religious beliefs. Morrisville is an inclusive and diverse community where people of all backgrounds are welcome. In our town, we do not condone hate speech or discrimination, and we strive to make our community a safe place for all, end quote. On the day, the concrete company was given tent space at the entrance to the park, away from most of the other vendors and far from the lawn where the action, including the drag bingo and performances from the bands 22 Strings and Against the Odds, was taking place. The company's three representatives bought no goods to sell but had two concrete millstones painted with rainbow and trans pride colors. In flyers distributed at last year's event, and in response to request for comment from Indy, the company said that the millstones represent Bible verses, making allusions to pedophilia and Babylon as a symbol of sin. The group's tent was quickly surrounded by some two dozen protesters, obscuring its visibility with umbrellas and flags emblazoned with rainbow stripes and trans pride pink and turquoise. Morrisville Town Council member Anne Robotti was among the protesters, carrying a sign that read, "Do not engage," in rainbow letters and humming along to "Let It Go" from Frozen. She says her strategy is to oppose the group symbolically, not to engage with them, because engagement is what they want. She says, "I don't know why these haters from outside of Morrisville have to come and disrupt our event. Just their presence makes people feel unsafe, and I think that's their objective." Robotti said, as an ally to LGBTQ community, her objective is to preserve other people's joy. Quote, "For me, it's all about positivity and love, and for me, that is just negativity and bigotry and hate, and I just don't allow it in my life. It's very triggering for people, and it's just not fair. It's not fair. This is the antithesis of that message over there with Jesus' name in their mouth. Jesus was all about marginalized populations of people that no one else would love and could love, and Jesus was like, nope, I love them." Despite the literal and metaphorical millstones the concrete company dragged onto the scene, Pride in the Park was a hit. "Great event," wrote Betsy Burnham O'Connor on the Facebook page. "I love that the hate dude was completely walled in by Pride folks. Band was fun, too." Still, if the town of Morrisville wants the event to truly be representative, it will have to find a way to exclude participants who make others feel unsafe. Eli Cameron, the vendor who voiced concerns to the town council, further explained their reasoning in an email sent to town council members on Friday. Quote, "I would like to respectfully challenge the idea that participation as a vendor is the same as a protected right to free speech in public space. Vendor booths are not public forums. They are curated, regulated, and limited opportunities meant for small business, nonprofit, and community groups offering goods or services. If a group wants to protest, they have every legal right to do so, but that right does not include occupying a vendor booth under false pretenses, especially if they are not selling products or engaging in commerce." Instead of attending Pride in the Park, Cameron said they vended at Winston-Salem's Pride Cookout, a smaller but grassroots community effort this weekend. It was a decision, they said, that was grounded in safety. Quote, "To be clear, my concern isn't about protest or stifling anyone's free speech. It's about inappropriate platforming. The issue is the town continues to approve a vendor who is not there to sell but to push an agenda. Taking away space from local business and groups in a sanctioned space at a Pride event legitimizes their presence in ways that harm the community." All right, I have held on to this article for many weeks. It's actually an interview based on a release of a book, and the Firstborn, a Memoir, is the name of this book by Lauren Christensen, and this is a Q&A form interview with the author, and the title is "The Stiff Earth Bending a Little." The cover of the writer Lauren Christensen's memoir features a black blot, a hazy orange mass blooming outward. A poppy, probably, though the image lends itself to something more wound-like, something abstract and formless. In Firstborn, a Memoir, a woolly grief we don't have many words for looms large, but Christensen admirably finds a shape for it. Firstborn follows the loss of Christensen, an editor at the New York Times Book Review, and her husband, Gabriel Bump, experience when they discover that their unborn daughter, Simone, is dying in the womb. At 22 weeks, the couple, who lived in North Carolina at the time of the writing, Bump is a visiting professor at Chapel Hill and an occasional indie freelancer, also learn that Christensen's life is endangered the longer she carries the unviable pregnancy to term. Here, North Carolina's abortion laws come into grim focus. At the time, it was not legal to terminate a pregnancy after 20 weeks. As of July of 23, that time frame has dramatically shortened to 12 weeks, and Christensen must travel out of state for the procedure. Firstborn begins with Christensen and Bump holding the body of the baby they have eagerly loved and longed for, and then loops back, moving between Christensen's childhood, the couple's whirlwind love story, the death of a beloved grandparent, and finally, the devastating loss of Simone. Christensen's writing style is casual and candid, even as a depth of raw feeling wells up, articulating an isolating experience that many women have had or brushed up against. She writes, "My need for my mother felt as mighty as my need for motherhood for my daughter." The directive clear, tender, and immediate. Christensen and Bump have since moved back to New York, but were back in town for a March 25th reading at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. On that occasion, Indy called Christensen to talk about firstborn, grief, and writing. Christensen, "The actual way I landed on that title was that I had, for some reason, attached myself to a verse from a poem by Louise Gluck. It was from The Wild Iris. I had just read the poem before as I was writing and just really liked it. Hold on, I want to find the line. The stiff earth bending a little. It was the title of the Word doc as I was working on this, and my editor was like, okay, let's just leave it as the working title. And then eventually they were kind of like, this doesn't really work. It doesn't tell anything about what the book is like. Can you come up with something else? And then I saw that Louise Gluck actually published a book called Firstborn, her first collection of poems, and there's this title poem I really loved. When I saw that, I was like, this is perfect, and not even as a reference to Louise Gluck. It just felt like the most perfect summation of what I was trying to do. It clicked for everyone. But it was hard settling on the right kind of title. I didn't want to use her name for some reason. Her name is throughout the book. But that didn't feel exactly what I wanted it to be. The rest of this is a conversational Q&A form. The thematic resonance of you also being your mom's firstborn, was that established or did it, you know, glue things together? Definitely, she responds, because it's so much about my experience of being a daughter and the kind of motherhood that I grew up knowing, as well as this sense of, you know, she had to be born still. I did really want to make that very clear. A central part of my experience with her was the actual birthing, so that felt very meaningful to me. It's also an allusion to the fact that she wasn't my only child. She turned out not to be my only child, but without, you know, making that explicit, because I didn't really want this to be about my son. She will always be the first. I'm curious about the role of your mom in the book. Was that something that evolved with time? What role did she play between drafts? The first draft that I sent, I wouldn't even call it a draft. It's just what I had written for myself in the immediate moments after coming home from the hospital. I showed the document to my husband, and then he urged me to send it to my agent. That first document had nothing about my mom, beside the fact she was there with me throughout those 9 days. My agent was the one to very astutely and gently point out that he didn't know anything about my relationship with my mom besides what he was reading. And he was like, I feel that you're really writing around something. I can feel something there, and I want to encourage you to explore further because it feels like there's a really big piece of the puzzle that's there but not there. That was tough. Everything about Simone, everything about what happened, because it was so immediate, it just came out. I'm not going to say it was easy to write, but it just came out very naturally. The stuff about my mom was so much harder to write, a much less contained story. How do I decide which pieces for my over 33 years to put in? And also, you know, Simone will never read it. My mother will. Thankfully, we're very close, and I didn't do anything without talking to her and showing her many drafts, which in itself was complicated. I think it must be very hard to read what your child writes about you as a mother, good or bad. I think it was very emotional for her, and she's a very private person. So I do consider this a real gift that she has given to Simone to let me write about her in such an exposed way. I'm making it sound like I'm airing dirty laundry, but I don't think that's what it is. It's complicated to write about family, no matter what you're writing. Yeah, and it's not a surface portrayal in the way maybe my portrayals of other people in my life in the book are. It's deeper than that. Question. I looked up some of Elizabeth McCracken's writing referenced in Firstborn after reading this, and there was one interview where she talked about her approach to writing about her experience of stillbirth as an urge or a compulsion to write her son's memoir. Did you have a similar goal in mind? It's interesting to hear that. I hadn't seen that interview, and now I want to go look at it. I do remember looking at the dates and noticing her book was published several years after the death of her son, so it does seem like there would be a kind of intention there. Okay, what am I doing with this memory? In publishing, everything happened very quickly. I was writing, not thinking it was a book. When I came home from the hospital, the goal, if I had one, it was just all I could do. I had, thankfully, 6 weeks off from work for disability leave, and so I didn't actually have any actual responsibilities beside my dog, you know, so I did have this time. I wasn't really able to do anything other than write things down. I guess if there was a compulsion, I think that is a good word, it was just knowing how, even in that moment, even when I felt I would never not be grieving, knowing some part of the state I was in was temporary, wanting to hold on to that state. Like anyone who's grieved, you have this feeling that you almost don't want to stop being sad because then you'll feel like you'll be farther from the person that you miss. And in this kind of indulgence or safety and actively mourning, it just feels like I don't have to do or think about anything else. I wanted to document that, to preserve that immediate moment because it was so unlike anything else I'd ever experienced in my life. The decision to publish is a whole different story. I still struggle with it sometimes. What have I done? The ultimate thought I keep coming back to is the reason I wanted this to exist for strangers to read is just feeling like it in some minute way makes her exist in this eternal way far beyond me. Even if it just lives on a shelf somewhere. Can you explain how North Carolina's abortion restrictions played into your pregnancy and the decisions you had to make? At the time I was pregnant, which was the end of 2022 into the beginning of 23, the law restricted termination after 20 weeks and 6 days, and I happened to be beyond that point. Now, as we're talking, it's 12 weeks. Termination didn't come into my mind until it had to, so I wasn't aware of the law, to be honest, which I'm now a little bit ashamed to admit. It wasn't something that factored in. I wanted to keep my child. By the time we'd been to several doctor's offices, it became clear that Simone was not going to survive. She had severe organ failure resulting from genetic abnormalities. Essentially, she had kidney failure, which was explained to me by the time it was explained that I had a choice between continuing with pregnancy and waiting her to die on her own or terminating. I told the doctors termination could be on the table, but I'm not going to take that choice. But they kept trying to hammer this into me. It was very dangerous for me to continue the pregnancy. That part I still struggle to remember because I didn't feel sick at the time. But the longer her kidneys were failing inside of me, the more at risk my own organs became. Preeclampsia was the risk resulting from something called mirror syndrome, and all of this was just kind of medical terminology to me. I had this delusional belief that I could die and she could live. It had to be hammered into me the choice was between her dying or both of us dying. What came as a shock was when the doctors at Duke said to me, "Okay, if you choose to terminate to save your life, we can't do that here and we'll have to refer you out of state." I had somewhat recently moved here from New York, so I still had a very obvious place I would go. Childhood bedroom in New York. All my doctors still. It hadn't been that long since I'd emailed my gynecologist in New York. I had all these references ready to be called on, and that is what I did. I was able to fly up with my mother next to me, sleep in my childhood home, and recover there for a few days. It really struck me through that process. What I just kept thinking was, what would I have done if I didn't have such a safety net? Question. Prior to these restrictions, I think a lot of people weren't familiar with these scenarios and how common it is for doctors to have to intervene in non-viable pregnancies. We didn't have to think about it as much as before because it was legal, but also because it's really hard to put a shape around a miscarriage and pregnancies gone wrong, so people just don't talk about it. I feel like the terminology we have is sort of misleading. I don't really know what word to use for what happened. Was it a stillbirth? I had an abortion. I didn't technically have a miscarriage. There's this veneer of clarity, like you could just so easily put something in one category or another, but that just belies the actual complexity and greatness of the beginning of life. I continue to not know how to describe what has happened. I also want to say, I also feel uncomfortable suggesting that more people have to talk about things that happened to them. Just because I'm perhaps too comfortable talking about my personal experience, I don't think other people have to talk about it. What I hope is the people who want to, people who feel that it might help them, open up a conversation for anyone who takes part in it. But by no means do I think you have to share. You mentioned this Elizabeth McCracken book. Were there other memoirs or resources you looked to while you were thinking about how to approach this? There were books I'd read before that came back to my mind. I'm thinking of one in particular, Ariel Levy's The Rules Do Not Apply, which wasn't specifically a memoir of miscarriage. She wrote a really devastating essay about it, Thanksgiving in Mongolia. Yes, exactly. There was something about that immediacy. Unflinching is so overused, but did not spare the graphic details. And I remember reading that when it came out, long before I ever considered becoming a parent and feeling like, God, this is immediate writing. This is really in the trenches. I don't feel the separation between the page and the event, which is such a remarkable talent on the writer's part. This was something I wanted to do with my book, to preserve real proximity to the event itself. There are other memoirs. I'm thinking a lot lately about Joan Didion's Blue Nights that are more removed, you know, deliberately. It's more stylized, reflective consideration of a grief that happened somewhat in the past, but that just wasn't what I was writing. A brief article now from May 20th, which I've saved in my Read This If I Have Time, and it's about a political protest album, Is This America?, from a Durham musician. No one asked Robert Zimmerman of Duluth, Minnesota in the 1960s to become the voice of his moment in era, but as Bob Dylan, that's exactly what he was and what he did, writes Christie on his website. No one asked Duncan Christie of New York, New York, to try to become the voice and conscience of his moment, but that is exactly what I am trying to do and be. Writer and musician Christie is one of those rare people who has found his unique calling and hurled himself into it with absolutely no misgivings. Only a person of that much conviction could rhyme uterus with neuterus. In the song, my name is Stacey Abrams. I am the uterus, you are the spawn. No way to neuterus, wear the armor of the goddess of the dawn. That song is part of an album of political protest, Is This America?, that Christie says he was inspired to make after seeing the events of January 6, 2021 unfold. The 13 songs released in 2021 take a musical and often satirical look at Donald Trump's MAGA movement. I don't think we even grasp yet how profound January 6th was as an event, he says. It really was a wake-up call. In the congressional hearings about the events of the day, former police, Capitol Police officer Harry Dunn recalled sitting down after being assaulted and called racial slurs by the now pardoned rioters. How the F can something like this happen? He asked in the hearing. Is this America? Christie, now 4 years later, says, yes, this is evidently America, but he hasn't given up hope. He draws inspiration from his father, a Navy officer turned U.S. attorney, who was a lifelong Republican until he gave up on the party. I grew up with music, Christie says in a sonorous yet controlled voice. It was an era when Broadway shows were absolutely at their ascendant, and then the Beatles arrived, and I got a guitar, and listened to Bob Dylan, and listened to John Paul, and played with friends, and I loved it. Christie has previously written music about the Bush era and journalism, somewhat inspired by his past career as the editor of the Delta Airlines In Flight magazine. On top of his artistic work, Christie is involved in some more pragmatic political organizing, including becoming the Democratic vice chairman of his precinct. With songs like King Trump, quote, and while the Democrats sit on their hands and while they talk themselves blue, I am the one who's giving commands. And misinformation, disinformation. Except truth is the commonplace common man stuck on the ground. Lies are the shimmering carousel spinning round. Christie is aware that his music is much more on the nose than Dylan's more subtle question. Christie sings to me from his most famous song, how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? Blowing in the wind is almost like a koan. Well, you know implicitly, if you're not doing something to stop those, ban those effing cannonballs, we got a problem here. Christie is new to Durham. Like many, he moved from the Northeast to be closer to family, but as we chat, I can't help but feel he's found the perfect community to call home, as the deeply blue area struggles to find ways to meet the moment of American institutions unraveling. All right, I almost got through with that article, but John Federson has to say farewell now from this edition of the Indie Week, and it's available as a podcast at ncreadingservice.org if you want to hear it again. And I'll be back next week with another edition of The Independent. So for the North Carolina Reading Service, John Federson says thank you, everybody, for listening. Bye-bye.